Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. You're about to meet feminist artist Robin Kahn, whose practice includes not only painting, by the way, she paints every day, but also curating and making books. Robin's work, exhibited internationally since 1990, has been collected by and or included in exhibitions at the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney here in Manhattan, the Brooklyn Museum, the Smithsonian Museum of Women in the Arts, and the Carnegie Mellon Museum, to name just several. Robin says her artistic practice is committed to expanding the definition of art by exploring new strategies for engaging the public. To that end, she recently co-curated The Value of Food, Sustaining a Green Planet, with her husband, Kirby Gookin. He, too, is a public artist, an art writer, critic, and professor. I saw the exhibition, installed in the bays and chapels inside the massive, dramatic interior of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine on Manhattan's Upper West Side. It focused on issues of food security, sustainability, and accessibility. Robin's connection with food and art was first inspired in 2009 when she lived in Algeria with exiled families from Western Sahara. She created Dining in Refugee Camps, The Art of Sahari Cooking, a manual of art, images, and writing exploring how Sahrawi women consider the meal a celebration of their tradition, culture, and history. In 2013, Robin created an interactive installation at Documenta 13 in Germany. Robin's been the recipient of several awards, including a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. So, Robin, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So take us on your artistic journey, Robin. When did you begin expressing yourself artistically?
Oh, pretty much, I think, always. I think you just have a propensity when you're very young to communicate in different ways. And mine was always from drawing and painting and looking at paintings. And that's what I got joy out of. And I understood the language, whereas a lot of people, you know, I started to understand what was inside of the paintings, what was being expressed, and it was a very exciting vocabulary for me.
But you had to be exposed to the arts.
Well, I grew up in New York City, so
That doesn't necessarily mean anything. You just have a lot of access, assuming that your parents expose you.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, my dad was he was a great art appreciator, and so I was growing up, he would take me to museums and galleries, and that was a lot of our relationship was based on that.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
And so then that just kind of fostered?
Well, I think I started to understand the language that's inside of the paintings or being expressed, the cultural implications of a sculpture, how it relates to other sculptures of its time, what it's trying to express beyond just what you see.
Mm-hmm.
All of those, it's like a big puzzle, and all of that was very engaging to me. I also had a grandma who painted all the time in the basement of her house in New Jersey. And so we were kindred spirits. And in that way, I had a bit of a role model.
So in addition to being exposed, you're also talented.
I hope so.
I think that's fair to say at this point. So where did you go to college?
Well, I went to Barnard.
Mm-hmm, which is up in Upper Manhattan.
Right. It's right in the area where St. John the Divine is.
Right.
And my husband went to Columbia University, and that's where we met when we were like 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied art history, and so did he. And then I wasn't really trained in art per se. So I said, if I can get into a grad school, I'll be an artist. And if not, I'll just pursue being an art historian. And I applied and I got into Pratt Institute, which is a much nicer school now than it was when I went there. It was quite dangerous. But there were still really good teachers. And it just gave me the time to try all different kinds of mediums.
And make your match, so to speak.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Did that happen to you then? You met your husband. Did you also meet your other husband as an art, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it was time to just pause and learn all the techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And because I already inside of me had a lot to express, and it was, what are the mediums I'm going to do that in? And so my very early work was looking at the way women are conditioned in society to act a certain way that's probably very different than who they are. And so there's kind of secret languages that women have that was important to excavate and bring onto the surface, you know, questions about how thin are you, how beautiful, what is beauty, mm-hmm. what's being presentable, sayings like, she's so good you don't even know she's there, that kind yeah. of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so these were all sort of adages that we grew up hearing.
For but sure.
Very, very different from how we felt as these energetic, excited young women coming into the world. And so I was really interested in excavating that kind of imagery.
Because I said in the beginning of the introduction that you consider yourself a feminist artist.
Absolutely.
And so that was kind of inbred. I mean, that was just a given for you.
Yeah. I mean, I came to be a feminist growing up in the 70s mm-hmm. when I you know, found my own voice and started looking around the world and seeing so much inequity. And particularly for me in the sexes, that's, you know, it's absolutely unacceptable. And the idea that you still have to say you're a feminist is really sad.
I know.
So I think it's important to just add that to my list of jobs, I guess.
You paint, you draw, you mm-hmm. sculpt, so you work in many different mm-hmm. mediums. And I was using, when I was researching you, sexual attraction, that you embroidered thread on burlap stretched over tie-dyed and ink fabric. Where'd that come from?
That's great that you looked at that.
Yes, I do my homework, woman.
Well, I started to think about the high fashion chains, that like the Gucci chains or the different gold chains that people wear, even in the 80s hip hop, but more of that women are sort of adorned with these chains that are gifts from men, and it sort of puts them in a certain part of culture, you know? And so if the chain link is of a Gucci chain link, it's very recognizable. And they're all different kinds of chain links that are from different kinds of jewelry stores. And so I started to think of that, well, that's a beautiful thing, but it's also bondage, that kind of a chain. It's not a big one with padlocks, but if I started working with these high fashion chains and expressing different ideas through those, so it's sort of like that pleasure-pain kind of dichotomy of being stuck inside a culture that values mm-hmm. what you own over who you are.
You were clearly making a statement as yeah. well as expressing yourself.
Yeah, I did. The first ones were on pinstripe, which is the man's suit yes. that they wear for business. Yes. And I did quite a few different images on that. I did a whole series of balding men, so you could see them with full hair and all the gradations until sort of the loss of their power when they lose their hair. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the fashion district and I found the different ways of embroidering that are being done there, some on machines and some by hand. And I worked with people and had them embroider these really real gold chains onto pinstripes. So in a way, when you see the pinstripe, you know that connotes a man,
right.
a businessman, somebody who's quite wealthy and,
right.
you know, of a certain status. And then to have these gold chains right on top of them, mm-hmm. you know, and running through them, it almost connotes their property.
Huh.
And so that was, a way of discussing in a more abstract way, but the issues that are interesting to me.
Explain that process to me in terms of when something speaks to you like that, when you move from, and I'm using this term in quotes for lack of another word,
okay.
when you move from one phase to another, I don't know what is a better word than that.
It's very organic, actually. I think that you get an idea, you try to think of the best way to express it in materials,
mm-hmm.
and then from having that experience of working those issues out, actually making the thing, all of a sudden it opens up other ideas. And so it's a process.
So you could sometimes just be slammed by it, you know, that it's not calculated.
Yeah, for me it's very intuitive, but
intuitive,
it's also,
that's a good word.
Uh-huh. It's about the accumulation of ideas and visuals that you see every day, how people interact and who's on the street, what are they doing? Are they mostly shopping? Mm-hmm. Are they pausing? Are they pushing a little baby? You know, are they carrying the baby carriage up the stairs of the subway? Because they don't really accommodate women who are, have young children at all. And so you have to be sort of a superwoman to live in this city. And I think that is very much the inspiration of a lot of the work.
So it's almost a natural act for you to marry the artistic with the political.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, you can't help yourself. This is who you are.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's the art that interests me. I think actually all art is political, even if it's abstract, that you know where it comes from, why it was being made at that time. If it was freeing itself from some other kind of design that was more, you know, popular, if, mm-hmm. you know, it's always a reaction to something in culture. So
if you're just joining me, my guest today is feminist artist Robin Kahn. When you want to express yourself about something and you have something to say and then you put it out there, obviously you want it to resonate and you need to make money. It's not only your passion, it's your livelihood.
Yes.
How does that work? I mean, and it's not so much that I'm saying, do you earn a living being an artist? That's not what I mean, but that's what I mean.
There are processes that you learn as you grow as an artist. There are different ways of exhibiting your work or accessing spaces that where you can put your own work or put your work together with somebody else's work. I am a very collaborative worker, so I like to create projects where women can express themselves under some kind of rubric and not really curate so much as start a conversation with artists based on an idea and then see where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find by working with a lot of other women artists, we support each other. And even with men artists too, there's a kind of a mutual sense of support because we have so much in common. But for me, I went to art school. I worked at a commercial gallery for post-war art. And I learned all about how art is presented and sold to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just, there are spaces in all over the country that are not-for-profit spaces that are made to help young artists who don't have galleries begin to show their work.
And who are not represented, you mean?
Yeah. And so, they're made specifically for that, so you can get your foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience was there's a place in New York called White Columns. I had shown my work to the director. First, back then, you show them through your slides.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a phone call after maybe a year or two of just keep putting my work in there. And the director said he'd like to do a studio visit. And then he came to my studio, which was like two floors underground on Warren Street, really scary space. And I think on the second visit, he offered me one of the small rooms to show my work. And at which point, people would come not just to buy. It's not really about that. It's more that people in the art world who have galleries want to know what's happening, you know, and what's cutting edge and what ideas are being expressed by the young.
Uh-huh.
So from that, I was asked to be in several group shows,
mm-hmm.
and it sort of went from there.
And so you are able to earn your living.
I'm able to earn my living by doing a lot of things.
Right.
There have been years when I just could sell my art, and that was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also been very, very involved in public art projects, which is a little bit what I was touching on, and which have taken me to Spain to work on anti-copyright projects with a group of Spanish artists. And from those Spanish artists, I was invited to Western Sahara or Algeria to the camps where they had an art festival.
Let's stop there because I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Explain that whole experience. That's just fascinating. Did you even know who Sahari women were?
No. I had absolutely no idea.
So you just pack up and you're going to Algeria.
Well, yeah. I went with some Spanish artists because this country it used to be called Spanish Sahara, and it's underneath Morocco in Northern Africa. And in 1974, there was a big move to decolonize all of the countries in Africa and, in fact, give them back to their own people. Well, Spanish Sahara, Franco was dying. And before he actually made a secret accord between Morocco and Mauritania that they could take over Western Sahara. But it was, Franco was on his deathbed. It wasn't really well known. And so what happened is Morocco just, they staged something called the Green March so that it sounds really ecological and peaceful. And what it was is they just had tanks roll into Western Sahara and dropped white phosphorus and killed many, many, many people. And what, and the women and the children and the elderly all escaped across the desert to safety in Algeria. And they fought a vicious war until 1990. And then the UN brokered a ceasefire with the idea that the UN would have a referendum where Morocco and Western Saharans can sit down and Western Saharans can decide whether they want to be incorporated into Morocco or independent. And the problem is that the UN has never had that referendum since 1990.
Wow.
So it's left the women and their families in Algeria, in the hottest part of the Saharan desert, waiting to reclaim their land.
Wow.
Yeah. So what happened was when I went there, I heard about it through one of my Spanish art friends, and I was looking at the pictures because he had just returned, and I said the same thing. I was like, I'm well educated. I have never heard of this country or this struggle, and these images are amazing. So I'd like to go to the festival. And my idea was, well, where are they getting the food in these camps? How are the women preparing meals? Using ingredients that they can't grow, that is from humanitarian aid. How are they keeping their traditions alive?
How are they surviving?
Yeah, and why are they still having kids? You know, and they are. And so my project was to go. There are five camps in the desert, and I lived in one of each camps for a week each with a family, and I learned how the families get the food and what are their traditional meals and how they actually use the meal as a way of telling their story. And because they're a nomadic people, they have all of these customs that if somebody drops by your tent, they should come in and say what's going on in current events that they've seen while they were roaming around. But I mean, now they're not roaming anymore. But there are these really beautiful traditions of welcoming and hospitality that are used with the meal.
So you lived in five different camps.
Yeah, with a particular family,
right,
in each one. And some are nicer than others. There's definite social stratification. Mostly the men are not fighting, but they're in the military. So they're not in the towns. And that makes it a matriarchy, basically.
Huh.
Because initially when the men were fighting the war and from 74 to 90, the women were the ones who had to create a stable society. And so they erected these beautiful tents that are the nomadic tents, and they were filled with rugs and beautiful drapery and pillows and music and all of the things that connote home to them, even though it's in a place away from home. And they started the school system. There's 99% literacy.
Good Lord.
And they started the hospitals. And a lot of the people were actually trained to be doctors in Cuba and then came back.
How large was an average camp?
An average camp is
population
like 50,000.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How'd you communicate? Do you speak
Spanish?
Spanish.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
Do speak Spanish.
And many of them speak French too. They're the most educated people I've ever met. And so, you know, our idea of refugees as being these, you know, I don't know, substandard
yes.
human beings. They are so educated because they need to
survive.
They need to tell their story. They need to communicate. And if they're in a country that's speaking a different language, then they need to learn that language, you know. And so it was a very moving experience for me.
And very impactful, apparently.
Yeah.
Because you took this, I mean, this is now part of your DNA in a sense, right?
Yeah.
You know, that experience,
well,
right?
Well, yeah. And I also think we as women, I mean, we basically are in charge of the home. We're in charge of cooking and, you know, organizing and all of that. So there is a common language across cultures in that way.
What was your takeaway, your artistic takeaway, after spending this time in the camps?
Well, I actually made art right in the camps. So what I did is I took photos with my telephone and I took interviews from all sorts of women, and I got the recipes that they were making. And then I followed the women to where the food was being dropped, and I watched them pick up these huge bags and then lug them back to their homesteads. And if the women couldn't, you know, because it was too old or whatever, then their neighbors would bring it over. And there was this whole system of barter, that because there is no money there. Hmm. And that was really fascinating. So I was in a tent where the woman who was in charge of the tent had hurt her arm, and so she couldn't make bread in the morning. So our neighbor made two loaves in the morning and brought one over for us. And, you know, that was a system that I saw it right before my eyes. And it's sort of that utopian idea of what we all strive for, but I've never really seen it in practice before in such a clear way. So my takeaway was an incredible admiration for what women can do when they have to rise to the occasion.
So this was your first foray into food and art.
Yeah, because my project was to put together a cookbook that tells the story of the food, of the history, and of particular people and their experiences in the camp. And that's the book that I put together while I was there.
If you're just joining me, my guest today is feminist artist Robin Kahn. So now fast forward to this exhibit at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, which in and of itself is fascinating, not solely because of the exhibit, but because of the venue.
Oh,
that's not very common to have an art installation inside a church.
No, I don't think it's very common, although at the cathedral they do...
Yeah, they break the rules.
Yeah, it's a very kind of left-leaning, creative place that's, you know, not typical.
So who gave birth to that idea? And how did you and your husband start this project?
After I left the camps, I was invited to be in an international exhibition in Germany called Documenta. Mm-hmm. And so there we set up one of those home away from home tents. And I invited 10 women from Western Sahara to come and be in the tent. And then the public would come in. And there was sort of an entryway with all collages.
How'd you pay for that?
They pay for it.
Okay.
It was an entryway with all collages that I had done to express my experience there. And then you duck down and get into this unbelievably beautiful tent. But from the outside, it just looks white. But on the inside, it's colorful and filled with music and mint tea. And you're handed a little cup of couscous. And you sit down at a table with a woman from Western Sahara. And you just talk over the food. And it was a very sort of generous art piece, and that opened up a lot of discussions.
And very interactive.
Yes, yeah, completely.
Perfect, yeah.
So I did that for 3.5 months. I want to mention that because it's incredible that the women came. They even have a minister of culture in the camps, and she flew over. And my husband is an art historian, and so he's always creating a context, in a way, around projects that I'm involved in. And we just started to put together a show on food and art that's post-war and how it grew from picking up a wrapper from the street and putting it into your canvas. And in post-war Italy, there were many, many artists who, like Alberto Burri, picked up a humanitarian aid bag of food, you know, and then affixed it to his canvas. And all of a sudden, then, it's not just food on the canvas. It talks about, wow, this is post-war. There's no food around. This is how you get your food. And also the idea of using every single thing that you have, you know. So we had started to put together a show and had been approached by someone who saw the cookbook and worked at the UN in Geneva. And we worked on it for quite a while, and then the funding fell through. Mm. So we had this sort of proposal, and at the same time, the cathedral had written grants to do 3 consecutive exhibitions. The first one was called The Value of Water, and this one is The Value of Food, I'm not sure what the next one is. It's the value of something. The value of water was 5 years ago, I think 5 years ago, and it was sort of curated in-house. And there was one artist who put it together and invited other artists too. And because I had been working in sort of the art world vein in a kind of more visible way, the word got out. Somebody knew that Kirby and I had been working on this, and they were looking for a curator at the cathedral. And so we walked in with a full proposal, and it was, you know,
a no-brainer.
Yeah, it was a no-brainer. Uh-huh. Yeah, but and it took 9 months to actually put the show together because there are 14 bays and 7 chapels, and you know, including the main nave, and it's an incredible space. And in the beginning, I was so panicked because, oh my God, there's another room. How are we going to create something that makes sense for the viewer to, you know, really grab onto and not get lost?
You had to find all the artists.
Oh yeah, Greg. Oh yeah.
And there's obviously a ton of them.
There are 35 artists.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So this must have been an amazing undertaking to find, you know, these 35 artists, all of whom are, it's so eclectic.
There is
a common bond.
Right. We
here.
Tied it together by grouping artists within the food cycle. So it starts with water, and then it goes soil, seed, farm, market, meal, waste.
Mm-hmm.
And so then waste goes back into the soil again.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you go through the cathedral, you follow the food cycle. And that was one of the first decisions that we made as a way of organizing the exhibition. And then finding the artists. There are artists with big presence online now, and met a lot of them through Skype and told them the project. And everybody was so excited, not only to collaborate on this level, but to exhibit in such an amazing space.
Exactly.
That's so not traditional art space.
How'd it go working with your husband?
Well, it was great. Actually, it was really, really great because, we both do similar things, but we also have complementary aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
kind of separate but equal.
Yeah. And he'd been working on his own projects for a while, and I had been doing my own art projects. So to come together after having been educated in art history like 3 blocks away at Columbia and Barnard, and this had been our backyard
exactly.
when we were kids,
uh-huh.
and it became this really exciting adventure for us, really engaging. And of course, there's deadlines that one's not meeting and the other one, you know, there's all sorts of things like that. But mostly, it's been the most positive experience. And it's great after 35 years of marriage to be able to, you know, engage your brain together in a different way.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, this always blows my mind. We're just about out of time. So what's coming up for you, or what's in your immediate future? What are you working on?
In my immediate future, I'm painting every day. I'm working on a new series of work that is pretty much abstract. And
mm-hmm.
it started using party napkins, because I noticed that napkins that you buy for different parties, you know, they have very interesting designs on them. And it is something that's still being done, you know, if birthday parties or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that started to be the material I was using and deconstructing into these abstract paintings. And now I've been building them out of sort of the end papers of books, those kind of swirly, beautiful colored
mm-hmm.
end papers,
mm-hmm.
and putting together, sort of deconstructing them and then putting them together back as these sort of swirling landscapes of thought.
So if people want to see your work, it's robinkahn.com.
Yeah, exactly. K-A-H-N.
Yeah, make sure we get that spelling right.
There's a lot of stuff on there, and hopefully a lot more projects to come.
It certainly sounds like it. And it just also sounds like you're really in a great place for you, and that there's always some kind of an inspiration that every day brings with it something new for you. How great it is to live like that.
I hope everybody feels that way about what they've chosen to do.
Robin, it's been nothing short of my pleasure to get to know you. And thank you for sharing your life, because it's really, really fascinating. And I'm so proud of my instincts.
I'm proud of you, too. It's great to meet you.
It was really lovely. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have an idea for an interview, contact us at www.sandyclineshow.com.